and welcome to the Neurodivergence and Mental Health Podcast. My name is Sally Nilsson, and I'm a psychotherapist, published author, public speaker, and mum. I discovered my autism and ADHD aged 56 in March 2021, and having rewritten my life story, I'm on a quest to advocate for neurodivergent community. I hope you enjoy listening to my incredible guests sharing their experiences of autism, ADHD, dyslexia, dyspraxia, dyscalculia, Tourette's and OCD. We talk about growing up, education, work and personal stories and how mental health has played its part in shaping lives. Our conversations cover spectrums, traits, challenges, acceptance and successes. So sit back, relax, and find out what it means to feel, think, and be different in a neurotypical world. Today I'm speaking to Kathy Carter, who, like me, is a hypnotherapist and counsellor. From what I've read about your life, I see so many similarities. I'm going to be talking about your early life experiences. We will also be talking about the mind-body connection with neurodivergence and mental health, how we experience menopause on the spectrum, and a subject close to my heart, which is masking. So, Kathy, please introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us about your own unique neuro profile.
Hi, Sally. Thank you for having me. I would say my profile is quite typically autistic. I'm quite structured, I'm quite organised in my personality. I can be driven by anxiety sometimes, but I'm quite stoic and reflective as a person. As a therapist like yourself, I'm quite aligned with kind of holistic principles and nervous system principles and this sort of all-body approach. And I actually think my autisticness really lends itself to that, this sort of quite focused way we have of really delving into something really interesting and exciting.
Absolutely. And if only people realized how important it was, that mind-body connection. And it's the more I find out after the last 2 years since my diagnosis, the more I realize that it's so young. You know, we learned a whole load of stuff over 100 years or whatever. Of course, we've been around for many thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, but it's all new again because the stigma's come down and so many people are coming out. And we're going to delve into that. And I'm really excited about talking to you about that and about hypnotherapy. Mm-hmm. And so when you were diagnosed, you know, what was your experience of the assessment, diagnosis and post-diagnosis journey?
I was really lucky, Sally, to be honest. I started looking into autism when my son, who was around 3 at the time, started showing some signs, I suppose, of difference. And I thought there's something sort of unique about him going on there. So I started researching neurodiversity, I suppose. And in the course of that, just aligned, as so many middle-aged women do, with so many of the sort of traits of being autistic. So I was so lucky. I feel a bit awkward just saying how great it was, because I just know this is not representative of so many people's experience. But I went to my doctor in the November, saw a locum doctor, and by July the next year, I'd had my NHS diagnosis, and it was really good. I saw a clinical psychologist. A lot of it was kind of luck, postcode lottery.
Yes.
Where I live, there's at least then, 6 years ago, there was this sort of private contractor who took on the sort of referrals for autism diagnosis for adults and children, as it was then. I just hit the sweet spot, I think, when I just got in really quickly, and it was a really smooth process. And, you know, you're still thinking then, oh, I don't know if I am. You know, even during the assessment, I was like, well, he probably won't. I probably, you know, I'm not that autistic. And when the report comes through, it's like, oh my gosh, okay. I guess it's true then. But yeah, I was really, really privileged. And yeah, my son went on to get his diagnosis of ADHD and he's autistic. I think a little after me, actually. Yeah, his came later. But yeah,
And
it was
yeah, you do kind of feel a bit of guilt about it, don't you? And these are some of the people that I've come across late diagnosed, whether we're male or female,
good.
is because we know how awful it is being. And I can't see it improving for ages because there's such a backlog, as well as all the physical backlogs with the NHS as well. It is really hard. Something that I've definitely come across is quite a lot of late diagnosed people, they sort of get through the assessment and often they've done a lot of research, an awful lot. So they're very self-aware. And then they go through the waiting process, which is really anxiety building. They get the diagnosis, but it's almost like when you have children, it doesn't matter how much you read about it and how much you know about it, it's quite mind-blowing. And so I get people coming to me with grief and a lot around identity and who are they and well, what do I do about it now? And I also get people who say, well, I thought a lot would change and everything would be a lot better. But me included, sometimes I kind of think, actually, it was almost better when I just thought I was bonkers because I keep finding another thing and having to learn about that all the time. What do you think about that with your clients as well, Kathy? That post-diagnosis bit, really?
Yeah, it's so different for everyone, isn't it? I do quite a bit of work for Thriving Autistic, the social enterprise. So I will see quite a few clients for their post-diagnosis support session. And it really varies, Sally. Like some people are just obviously overjoyed, relieved. They finally found their clan, their kinship. They finally understand themselves. But a lot of people are really in limbo. It's like they're still not quite believing it.
Yeah.
There's, like you say, a lot of grief about missed opportunities, missed kind of attunement that we could have had with our families and friends and so on. This sense of difference that we've always had. There's a bit of, I guess, almost anger as well, a bit of unfairness around that. I think all these things fly around like fireworks, and it takes a while for those to settle,
Yeah.
months at least. And then we come to terms with it. And for me, I was completely absorbed in everything autistic
Yes.
so long, just so many rabbit holes, so many, just every waking hour was, research and study and everything else. But eventually that quite frantic obsession settled. And yeah, now it feels just quite a settled way to be. But I know when I see people who are straight out of the trap, if you like, straight out of the race and into their new identification, it's very confusing. And imposter syndrome, this sense of, I still don't believe it. I still can't really wear that hat or accept that diagnosis. It feels like a confusing time. And I suppose that's what we do as therapists, to help people just settle into the confusion. Like, it's
Yes.
okay. It's
Yes.
okay. It's normal.
And I agree. I mean, I am very visual, and not all autistic people are, but I'm a visual pattern matching detective. That's who I am. And so I had to, I mean, I am driven literally by a motor inside of me to find out everything I need to know. So that is labels. I need those labels. I want to know what alexithymia is. I want to know what rejection sensitivity dysphoria is. And there's so many of them. However, as you said, is you get to a point when you think, okay, tick, I can tick that one off. I know what that is. Oh, yes, I am dyspraxic and I'm dyscalculic and I'm all these different things. And then one day you arrive at this place and you think, I don't actually need to do that anymore. Here I am and I know who I am. But where we come in as autistic psychotherapists and counselors is we help those people once they've got the come out of the trap and once they've got the diagnosis, because it is so hard. And I don't know about you, Kathy, but I found myself being quite a lot of a coach and a mentor and giving a lot of resources. You know, how do you find your model of I'm just adding something on here because it's just interesting. How do you find your model of therapy may have changed now Are you doing more coaching and sort of giving research resources and psychoeducation than you did before?
I think because I've always been an autistic therapist, if that makes sense, and
Okay.
a lot of my clients are neurodivergent, probably about 80%. I think I've just always lent into that area anyway. I mean, you obviously, it depends on the client and what you're working on. Yeah, I would often be, introducing these new terms like you were saying, or the double empathy problem. Often this is a stage where the clients are collating info. So if you can offer them, signpost them to something which is useful, social meetups, neurodiversity friendly resources, I sort of feel like it's almost a bit of a duty, really,
Yes.
without imposing our opinions and our views and everything. So yeah, it does have that aspect of coaching initially, at least, especially in the first few sessions. And then I suppose, like us, if these are newly self-identifying or newly diagnosed people, they'll sort of settle into it. But in the early stages, I think you're info gathering, aren't you? You're trying to understand, you're trying to get a picture, and all of these bits of psychoeducation, they're like jigsaw pieces, really, aren't they?
They are. I mean, I don't, I don't think it's that dissimilar to being a GP and when they come with symptoms. We call them traits, don't we? But it is quite interesting if our client feeds us something and says, I have a problem with communicating with my husband. I don't think he's neurodivergent, but I am. And then all of a sudden you'll go, oh, there's double empathy. And then you can give them the information for them to have a look at and make their own mind up about it. And then you can talk about communicating because it's a different language, and do that. So yeah, it's fascinating and really enjoyable. Now we're going to delve into that a lot more, but as I always do, I'm running before I can walk with you. So let's just go back to what your early years were like, Kathy. What was it like for you at home and at school?
I unfortunately tend to look back and align more with the negative experience and the negative memories, and I don't know how much of that is the truth of the matter. Like all therapists, I have therapy myself, and you end up talking with your therapist about such matters. But I do often just feel the need to process the more difficult things. It was confusing. I grew up in quite a rural area. I was an only child. Just confusing. This sense of not fitting in, but not knowing why, like assuming it's all your fault. Just navigating the friendships was always tricky, always difficult.
Yeah.
I think the era was tough. We're of a similar age, and just growing up in that sort of 70s style of parenting, like my parents' parents were born at the very end of the Edwardian era, and that's what my parents knew, from their life experience. So it was quite a different era. There wasn't any emotional literacy, not in my house anyway. There was lots of smacking. There was no sort of awareness of difference and, supporting your emotional journey.
Yeah.
Not like nowadays. I think we're hopefully more informed and aware when we're bringing up our children about letting them process their emotions. So yeah, I do feel when I look back that it was difficult. My teens, it's very up and down as I look back at it. I know we're maybe going to talk about masking a little bit, and
Yes.
that was a time for me when my masking really kicked in. But it was a time when I was quite poorly as well in my teens. I was just constantly exhausted. So I look back with very mixed memories, and I'm trying obviously to be very accepting and compassionate towards my younger self. But yeah, it does leave me feeling a little sad, actually, for us, these neurodivergent kids who weren't noticed, weren't seen and supported. And I just hope things are changing now.
I think they are, and I do agree with you. Bullying, not fitting in, and definitely not allowed to show emotions at home, and being humiliated if you did, and sent to your room when what you needed was a cuddle and all those sort of things. But in my 58-year-old self now, I have forgiven, and I'm not a religious person, but for me, forgiving everybody, no matter what they did, is so cathartic and freedom making for me.
and understanding it was a different era. We didn't know about mental health, let alone, we knew that there were mental hospitals, you know, well, that's what we used to call them at the at that time. And then it went into care into the community. So you would see some schizophrenic people on the street and alcoholics and people like that. But we didn't have mental health, let alone neurodiversity. So we just got on with it. And I know resilience is a difficult word for a lot of people because a lot of people need a lot of support and a lot of help emotionally. But I'm pretty tough. I wasn't at the time, but I am
Yeah,
now.
you learned how to be.
You do. So I definitely a similar journey. And actually, I would do it all again, exactly
Would
the same,
you?
because I loved living in the 70s and 80s. So how was your transition, Kathy, from education into the world of work?
Again, I think it was good and more luck than judgment, perhaps. So I left school when I was 16.
Gosh.
I was very pleased to get out and leave home as well. So it might have been possibly where I lived, but just going to uni, being academic, wasn't the thing that everyone did. So I did an apprenticeship to work with horses, and that was my get out. That was how I escaped what was quite, I guess, an unpleasant or unsupportive and not very pleasant and exciting life at the time.
Yeah.
So I went off to train to be a riding instructor, and I did that for 6 years. So you're working with animals, very non-judgmental. There's all of the therapeutic aspect of being with animals, communicating with animals, attuning with them. So I was lucky that that was my introduction into the workplace, because the hours are strange. You know, you're not stuck in an office doing a 9 to 5. It brought me lots of flexibility, which I probably needed, a lot of
Yes.
spontaneity and new exciting things. So that part was great. And then I retrained in my early 20s, and went off and did media stuff. And I did that for, gosh, I don't know, 20 odd years or something. And when I was in a proper workplace, that's when all the struggles came in. But all the time I've been curating my own workspace, like I did when I was sort of a teenager, being a riding instructor and working in stables, I've got on fairly well. Like my, I guess, autistic challenges weren't too bad, but as soon as I went into the workplace, so I worked in advertising and marketing and publishing and these sort of media places,
Now,
that was more challenging. So I'd get anxiety, I'd get IBS, I would be quite poorly. In my teens, I had, I was diagnosed with ME,
oh,
myopic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue
yes,
syndrome. More likely just chronic autistic burnout.
yeah.
But as I say, when I sort of left and ploughed my own furrow, things, my health improved. So yeah, again, but of course I didn't know any of the autistic elements back then, but naturally, intrinsically, I somehow knew that I would be better suited to this quite fluid working for yourself type way of being, not
That's
in an
such an
office surrounded.
incredible journey. And just a few things that came out of that for me. When you were talking about the horses, my brain went off to Temple Grandin and the book Pretending to Be Normal. And so I don't know who wrote that. I'm terrible with names, but you know, there Temple Grandin, you know, with the cattle and what she did there. But that work with animals, you know, is just so incredible, and having that freedom. And I was in sales and management for 15 years, and that was advertising and exhibitions and marketing.
Oh, really similar, Sally.
It was. And the thing, the coping mechanisms, you see, this is where, excuse me, when you've met one autistic person, you've met one autistic person, and we will all have coping strategies. We didn't know we were autistic, and for me, ADHD. And for you, it went into your gut, and it went into you as getting ME, which is how many times am I seeing that, and fibromyalgia and autoimmune disease and diabetes and things like that. For me, I didn't have those. I did get celiac, but that wasn't until 2007. And I do believe that that was stress. But what I did is I turned to alcohol. So I must have killed all the baddie bugs and everything else with vodka, I suppose. So that was what I used in order to cope. But, you know, and it worked.
Oh, yeah, it's a very efficient coping strategy, isn't it?
And we have these, you're right, and we have these coping strategies. I'm really into the evolution of psychiatry. And they're all these things, anxiety, depression, stress and addiction, they work. Unfortunately, they don't do us any good. So we need to try and find other things. But at the time, they work, don't they? And and for me, alcohol was, because I started masking when I was 8 years old, but I didn't start drinking until I was 18. But masking it, you know, alcohol, it dropped my mask and made me into this, you know, frivolous, climbing on tables, hilarious sort of person. And let's talk about masking, because it's such an important subject. And a lot of people don't realize how important it is, because you can't just rip off somebody's mask, you know. So I realized, you know, as I say, I was eight, but kids didn't like me. So I had to pretend to be somebody else. And when I had masked at school, specifically when I was a teenager, coming home absolutely exhausted. And so my parents got the meltdowns and the shutdowns and all these sort of things, and they hated that. But then when they went to parents' evening, they got, well, actually, they got someone who was distracted, but I wasn't naughty, you know, and they didn't understand. And that happens a lot, doesn't it, with kids who behave really well at school, but they come home and the parents think it's the school's fault, because they don't understand about that needing to decompress. So how did you, what happened with you with masking, and what's been your sort of life understanding around masking and what you do now in your work?
Well, I think I probably started masking a bit later. I was quite sort of silly and playful, I think, as a younger child. And that carries you through, or it carried me through probably until my early teens, when all the other girls are sort of starting to grow up a bit more and be more mature. So I think I got away with that persona reasonably well. But then when I went to high school or secondary school, I needed to create something, you know, a bit different, a bit more socially acceptable. But it probably still took me to my mid-teens to really work out what that was. And I was, I think, the same in lots of ways. That's when I sort of discovered drinking as well. And yes, it relaxes you and it, you know, can bring on this disinhibition a little bit, but it also makes you feel more sort of socially acceptable, more fun, more gregarious, more interesting. So I think that was quite a big part of my social masking anyway, as an adult, or a teen, late teen into adulthood. And that carried on, Sally, right up until, well, very heavily in my, I would say, 20s and 30s, this sort of persona of, I guess, yeah, just drinking to excess at a social event just to fit in. You know, the thought of going to a work party or a wedding or something with no alcohol was just impossible.
Not going to happen. No, absolutely not. No,
it was an absolute crutch. But yeah, I think I've used masking a lot, and only really realised probably when I had my autism diagnosis that I needed to peel off a lot of layers and work out who was the real me. But I think I'm possibly, my viewpoint on it is a little different to some people's now, in that I see it compassionately and as a tool and as a part of us almost. So for me, I would be encouraging people, as you say, not to kind of just rip it off and go, yay, this is the real me.
Oh, God forbid.
Yeah, really get to know, you know, what it is, when we do it, why we're doing it, and all the benefits of doing it. You know, it's possibly conserving energy. You know, if you can just mask, if you're seeing a neighbour and you know they'll want to chat about something, and you create some kind of persona just to get through that communication. Whereas your real authentic persona would have just been really rude and quite abrasive, probably.
Yeah.
So you can use it just in ways to get you through life, to be, you know, socially acceptable in these little windows of time, or to conserve energy, or to earn money, you know, if you're masking in the workplace. So I kind of do this thing, I suppose mask mapping would be what I call it, when we map the mask. What is it?
Oh,
When
I
did
love
it?
that.
I know it's so. I find a lot of people are wanting to completely move away from their mask and be their true authentic self, which is
Yeah.
great. But for me, it's like, well, okay, pause. What is it? What part of you is masking? It's protective, isn't it? It's always
Yes.
protective, a mask. Is it conserving energy? Is it, hiding a fear of failure? Is it hiding something different? Is it a mask of perfectionism? What's driving it? What beliefs are driving it? Is it my dad's beliefs or my granddad's beliefs
Yeah.
or something from my family around I should be this, I should be that? And then picking it apart a bit and going, okay, well, what values are behind that? And if that's not the right value, what are your true values and how does that fit with the mask? So you're really getting to know it as a part of you. And that's for me how I see it, not only with clients, but with myself now as a compassionate. I'm compassionate towards it. It's not a terrible thing that I've used and I'm throwing it away in the bin. It's okay. Well, thank you, mask. You've served me really well. You've looked after me. You've got me through the workplace, through donkey's years of working with other people. Now let's find out a bit more about you and learn to be intentional. Learn
Yeah.
to be intentional. So you take it off. Hopefully, when you're in your safe surroundings with safe people, you feel okay enough to be yourself. But yeah, pick it up when you need to. That's my outlook, Sally.
Oh, I like that. I really like that. And that definitely works. And a couple of things that come out from that is one is the relationship between and the connection between masking and control
Yeah.
is I think there's a connection there, isn't there? Where you can teach people to have choice, to say, I choose to be able to have the mask because it is serving me for that purpose, as you're saying about intention. And I think that's, that is really useful. And the other thing, quite a lot of us autistic therapists are very keen on internal family systems,
Yeah,
where we
me
look at the different parts of us. So we'll have the central self part, which is, just us standing in the middle. And then we have the different parts of our characteristics and personalities standing around. And the masked person will be one. And as you're saying, you thank people. Well, you can ask that other Sally or that other Kathy in your mind. So how are you today? How are you using your mask today? Are you in a situation where you feel safe and you feel like maybe you can lower the mask with that person? And you really can have a positive internal dialogue, can't you?
I love that type of work. I just find it, I feel like it really fits neurodivergent people. So parts work and IFS work is just such a fit for our brains. And I think when people are new to, I guess, therapy as well as the field of autism and neurodivergence, it feels a bit weird and a bit strange to do that. So you're saying to your client, well, let's ask that lump in your throat. Let's ask that protective part of you what it needs. How is it
Yeah.
feeling today? And that's quite a jump, isn't it, from day-to-day life, believing we're a whole entity,
Yes.
to reframe it as having different parts. But I believe that that's a great way to heal and to get to know ourselves. So I certainly invite people to work in that way if it's something they align with and they like doing. I literally had a client a few days ago who I guess met his inner voice, like his inner critic, for the first time, and he's
Wow.
always run away from it and hated it and feel angry at it, and all of a sudden he was just like, oh, it's just scared. It's like a scared teenager. It's just
Yes.
someone needing support and love and connection. And just that shift of angry at the voice, get out of my head, I'm shameful, I'm guilty, to oh, okay, just like let's work on this together. It's such a shift, isn't it, Sally,
Oh.
to feel that.
It's wonderful. And I think with that as well is that I'm a human givens trained therapist, but I am doing a lot of study and training around things like internal family systems and other models that suit me. You know, at the end of the day, you can have as many models and qualifications as you like, but it's the harmony between the therapist and the client at the end of the day. But what you're talking about there is kind of transactional analysis in a way, you know, as well is interesting with the adult, parent and child. You know, are you talking to the child today? And then there's that thing as well where you can have like empty chair, where you can work with the part that is sad for their younger person or upset and angry with their father. And you can, you know, using hypnotherapy, for instance, and guided imagery, you can talk to the person in trance, you know, which is just amazing, actually. And I don't know if we've I'm just having a, just bear with me for a second. Yeah. So for you, I just want to ask you about that, actually. Mm-hmm. A lot of people sort of say, oh, you can't do metaphor with autistic people. And and some autistic people aren't visual thinkers. So the imagination side is can be a bit difficult for that. But it's not impossible. And I certainly use guided imagery and hypnotherapy with autistic and ADHD clients. Do you? And how does that work for you?
I do use it. So my sort of background is hypno-CBT. So less of the sort of trance state. And certainly there are limitations, I would say, for some clients. So, for example, some of the CBT type work doesn't really, I guess, respect the more neurodivergent, inflexible way of thinking. So you do have to adapt the behavioural aspects to neurodivergent clients. And aphantasic clients, you can't really see, you know, the picture things that way. Even some more ADHD clients who've got that much faster processing will find it quite difficult, I think, just to really sit and engage that relaxation response and just sink into the body. And trauma as well, goodness, you know, that's not really safe, is it, for people who've experienced a lot of trauma, just to connect to the body and show up with the emotions and face what's actually quite difficult. So I think we probably all just really sit with the client we've got on that day. But yeah, certainly guided imagery is really great. Sort of these dialogical conversations with parts of ourselves. I do like with the cognitive behavioral side, the sort of reframing, because we're quite, autistic folk are quite, I guess, structured and a bit inflexible. So if we have a belief, it's very often properly ingrained, isn't it, you know, that it takes a lot, black and white thinking, you know, it takes a lot to move away from that. So using the CBT aspects or the behavioral aspects in general, just to challenge, you know, where's the evidence for that?
Exactly.
Are they all going to be staring at me in the room? You know, will I forget my speech? Just working through some of the beliefs and changing all that, and then using a bit of hypnotherapy to embed some of the new thought patterns and processes and intentions can be really lovely. I do like ACT as well, acceptance and commitment therapy. And I think with some folk who are neurodivergent and more of the fast-brained, fast-processing personality, that can be really useful. So almost that defusion or detaching from the belief or the thought, rather than trying to get a person into a really relaxed, you know, sort of deep state when they're properly connected to their body, something a bit more higher up, I suppose. So, you know, it's more dynamic. The process is dynamic and they're talking to you. And so less relaxation, perhaps, and more dynamic work. But always, I just love doing like progressive muscle relaxation and tension release breathing, because no matter who you are, if you're neurodivergent, you're going to have a heightened nervous system. That's part of the course in my book. So learning how to just regulate and, you know, get to know what your little triggers are for feeling heightened, what sets you off into meltdown, and learning to get to know your body and what calms you, what soothes you, all of that can be done with hypnotherapy, I think.
It can. And I get everything that you're saying there. And I love the fact that you have your way of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I do agree. It just depends who the client is in the room on what you're able to do, you know, how what type of trauma it is, for instance, and what life experience they've had. So similar to your ACT, I think I've got one that I've created called MAC.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be managing traits.
Mm-hmm.
So some people will come with neurodivergence and they have particular traits that are really difficult. So rejection sensitivity dysphoria mm-hmm. is the one that is front and center. And mm-hmm. and with that, then we can look at reframing, you know, so I can do reframing or it depends, you know, if I have an autistic person who has had a really difficult time, bullying or domestic violence or anything like that, then it is very gently helping them to feel within their body. And we have to be very careful with that. And what you're saying about trauma is true as well, because I'm a rewind, I can do the rewind technique with trauma, which is much easier with neurotypical clients because you can go into that deep trance.
Mm.
You can't necessarily do that, you know, if you can't visualize. So it is really important that we do no harm and that we're very careful with our clients, you know, isn't it, Kathy, that we just have to work with what we've got in the room and what suits them.
Yeah, and I think that should go for all neurotypes of clients. So for me, like I see quite a few people who don't even want their screens on. You know, I think you've just got to really work with what's happening on the day.
Yes.
And last week, someone might have been really regulated, you know, really engaged with their emotions, really able to connect all that higher cognitive function. And yeah. then the next week, because of whatever's happening in their environment, they are verging on shutdown. They're exhausted. They find it hard to even, you know, talk coherently, let alone process all these very sophisticated aspects. So I think probably as therapists, if that's all we do is just work with who we've got in the room on the day.
Yes.
And fit what we do to them intuitively, I kind of think you can't go wrong, and hopefully you would do no harm and, you know, just give them what they need on the day. So it's always their agenda. But especially with neurodivergent folk, I think that probably is even more.
It is.
Important, isn't it?
I have thrown quite a lot of scripts away and the way that I used to do things, because what you just said about a client, I mean, how extraordinary. I do notice this a lot more with autistic clients, that one week they come and they're just a completely different person. And then the next time they come and they're very highly emotional, or they're completely shut down. And
yeah.
and we're much more flexible, I think. We're much more flexible with our neurodivergent clients. Well, I am, because mm-hmm. sometimes they might call me or email me, you know, even that morning and say, I am so sorry, but I have woken up with a migraine.
Mm.
And I just say, it's okay. You know, yeah. and, you know, perhaps we would be more inflexible before, but anyway, not now. It is different. So let's move on. Thank you so much for that. Really fascinating stuff. And talk about the menopause.
Mm-hmm.
And oh my gosh, what an enormous subject that is. It's a very difficult subject, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Part of me, just as a human being, thinks that all of us who have periods and have given birth, we all have the menopause, as we all have started our periods and have babies, and the menopause, which is a complete natural thing to do. But hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands of years ago, we had much smaller communities. We would have had sisters, aunts, other people supporting us, and we would have just had so much more support during those times. So when we might have really struggled, we didn't work, we rested, and we got through that time, and we don't have that now. We have to work and bring, you know, look after our families and do all these other things as well. And it's very, very difficult for a lot of us. Quite a lot of neurodivergent women really struggle with an extreme form of premenstrual tension, PMDD, and also may have endometriosis, and very, just and all the sensory stuff as well. It's really, really difficult. So I didn't struggle too much. I tried HRT. It did work for a bit, but I didn't really like it. But I get a lot of women coming into therapy around menopause. So hard. I hate that expression. I've got it in my head now. So. Sorry about that. But it's rotten for a lot of women. Mm-hmm. What's been your experience about helping your clients in menopause, whether they're whatever neurotype they are?
So I'm, I think still in, well, I know still in perimenopause, and it's not been too bad. I think it's good to have experienced some of what your clients are describing and sharing. So, you know, that's a benefit that I have experienced a lot of the sort of signs and symptoms of menopause. I'm finding, Sally, that quite a few people will come for something else, whether it's, insomnia or just processing whatever's going on in their life, weight gain, whatever it is. And, you know, you look at their notes and, you know, you're talking to them, you see they're maybe in their 40s, not on any specific medications around HRT or anything. And I'll often sort of just broach it and say, well, you know, have you considered that perimenopause could be at play here? And quite a lot of people genuinely haven't. This goes for everyone, obviously, not just neurodivergent women, but just this, like, it creeps up on you and your age creeps up on you. And suddenly it's like, oh gosh, I am actually in the window for perimenopause. So it feels like a bit of a shock to some people. But I think what's interesting, what you've alluded to, is that the autistic body is very sensitive, isn't it? So
yes,
big life changes, you know, puberty, divorce, grieving, menopause. It's as if our body somehow, everything's amplified, you know, everything ramps up. And I think that menopause is one of the times when neurodivergent women really feel their autisticness. It's like everything is like turned up somehow, like the dial's ramped up. And I speak to some people who find that their sort of tolerance to medications, like, you know, when you read the symptom list,
yes,
what's it called when, you know, the risk factors for getting dizziness,
side effects,
side effects, thank you, Sally. I often find it's the neurodivergent women who will suddenly experience a lot more of the side effects, as if their body's just so sensitive and so heightened. So I think hypnosis is lovely for a lot of the symptoms of the menopause, whatever your neurotype. So again, with the beliefs, I think for a lot of us, just so much tied in with menopause, isn't there? You know, just all of the emotional stuff around what your body's doing and what your body now can't do and everything else.
Mm.
But just around coping skills, you know, sleep, am I ever going to get good sleep again? Is my body ever going to cool down again? I think there's lots around beliefs we can do with hypnosis just to reframe all of these troublesome aspects, you know, maybe create some anchors for coolness or just this awareness of regulation, like I can breathe, I can, you know, using a dial maybe to turn my dysregulation up or down.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's lovely. There's a lot of mindful practices as well that really work, especially if sleep's an issue and insomnia and things. So just that acceptance of where we are and almost seeing it as like a phase we're going through, you know, and if we need to really look after ourselves and cocoon and have a lot more self-care and a lot more acceptance, you know, that we don't have to push through against the symptoms. We can hopefully, you know, accept what's happening. And I think therapy, and especially hypnotherapy and mindfulness, is really useful for people going through menopause.
Oh, I do agree. And, you know, coming back to this, you know, we're poor women, men just don't have the menopause. I'm sorry, you know, and it is very, very tough, and we're not supported enough. And it is so hard. In the workplace, I mean, that's incredibly difficult. And I hope it changes. I hope government and leaders and bosses of companies and everybody will do an awful lot more to help women and support them, because it's so hard. And what you were saying about medication was interesting as well. I mean, I don't like to be able to say this. I'm not against meds at all, because I know that they can be incredibly life-changing for a lot of people. But it is quite difficult when I'm sat in front of a client that is needing, in order just to survive on this planet, they're needing to have an antidepressant.
Mm-hmm.
They may be on diabetes medication, because diabetes has come from not being able to cope and comfort eating.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so they're on an antidepressant as well. And then they're on HRT. They're on a complete cocktail of medication just to survive on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, Kathy, but for me, isn't that a sad state of affairs? And for me, it's because we are made in this society to conform to what is supposed to be correct, and to overperform and to perform. And it's just really, really difficult for people. So I know that you support people, and I advocate for people as well to try and help them in that situation, because it's a ripple effect. It affects the whole family. And that using a dial is fantastic in hypnotherapy. You can do it as a wakeful thing as well.
Mm-hmm.
And also using colour. So you can use red, you know, it's a colour for the menopause, but you can say, how deep is it today? You know, are you going into purple and black, or is it going more into pink and more, you know, of a translucent colour than an opaque colour? And where is it in your body? Where are you feeling it? And it's wonderful being a therapist, isn't it? Being able to use different strategies for our, you know, I just love. It's just such an incredible thing that we're gifted and able to do to help our clients, I think, isn't it? Do you think? We love your job.
I do. It's a privilege. It's an absolute privilege just to make the tiniest little bit of changes, guide people to realizations, or even just sit with them in their darkest hours and just be there. You know, it is a real privilege, and I don't forget that. It's it's very impactful, isn't it?
It is, and absolutely what you just said there, sitting in the room, and that's a person-centered, you know, we're all person-centered. I know, of course, we have Carl Rogers and we have a particular model of therapy, but I think we are all person-centered if we're good therapists. Because at the end of the day, this is why I think hairdressers are so good. You know, you just want to, at the beginning, in the first few sessions, is active listening, building rapport, and just being in the room when they're feeling so awful.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can start to build strategies and looking at little goals to make people feel better. But that's the harmony, the congruence, the being there, isn't it, with your client. So just so interesting talking with you, Kathy, and thank you very much. And I ask all my clients this because it's such an important question, and I love getting the different perspectives from different guests.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is your key message that you would like to give our listeners to help support neurodivergent people to live and survive and to thrive in a predominantly neurotypical world?
I think it's probably the same advice I would give anyone, in that if we can just develop a sense of knowing ourselves and of having emotional literacy with our loved ones and our family, and I don't know to what extent we can do it outside of that in the workplace, that's very difficult sometimes. But if we can curate a sort of a world where we're in touch with what we need, this can help with boundaries. It can help with working out our values in life. And if we just get to know ourselves a little bit more and express what we need a little bit more, and that could be adaptations in the workplace. It could be arranging, you know, sick leave, if you like, if you're in the workplace, so that you could take it if you're just a bit burnt out and exhausted, you know, mental health days. If it's about creating a life which supports your needs a bit more, that will help avoid burnout and periods of illness and mental ill health, and even things like, you know, unhealthy coping mechanisms and addictions and so on, if more people could curate this knowing, aware lifestyle, and with their children as well, you know, if we can, as parents, really introduce all this emotional literacy quite young, if schools would embrace it more, just society would be much more open and caring, and there would be less marginalization. It's a very lofty dream, isn't it? But individually, I think if we can just ask ourselves, you know, what do I need today? And try and affirm that in ourselves, that's just a good start, isn't it? And if it means staying in bed today and, you know, really giving myself what I need rather than pushing through, whether that's menopause related or neurodivergent related.
Yeah.
Really looking after, putting ourselves first a bit more and being kind to ourselves. If we all did that, I think it would ripple out to society a bit more.
I can't agree more. And in America, I mean, I'm a binge watcher of various different medicalized, mainly, or cooking, either of it's a bit strange. It sounds like Sweeney Todd. But, you know, this thing about personal days. And I think there's something around that. And I wonder, you know, if we created this utopian society, which is, you know, perhaps a bit too much to ask for, so that it can benefit men and women, and all of us, however we identify and who you know, who we are in, you know, as human beings, to be able to say something on the lines of, you know, in the workplace, so you're joining our company, and in our company, we will give you a set number of personal days a year. And they're not to be taken the mickey of, but these are used for specific things that you need, and we'll pay you. We're not going to not pay you for these. And so perhaps women could use them perhaps for the, you know, menopause or period pain or something like that. And men might just want to have a personal day to be with their children or to do something else, you know, to wind down, you know, whatever reason. It doesn't matter. It's none of our business what it's for. But if we had a certain amount each month, then we don't even have to have that menopause period conversation. The woman would be able to say, well, I do need to take 2 days off each month, you know. And it's fair then, isn't it? Because at least that stops burnout.
Oh, I love that, Sally. I think there are some very forward-thinking organisations, but a lot of them aren't like that. So, yeah, wouldn't it be great if everyone had that flexibility and that opportunity? Because then you're just curating. You're in the workforce, but you're curating a lifestyle that meets your needs. And that doesn't have to be about neurodivergence, does it? It could be about anything.
Yes.
It's just you're not just a number. You're not just a cog. You're a valued person with needs.
Yeah.
And let's just hope, shall we, that it moves in that direction.
And I hope so too. And I've so enjoyed our really, really inspiring and very interesting talk that we've had today, Kathy. So it just leaves me to say thank you very much indeed for coming onto the podcast. And it's I call this Bambi weather. We're just coming in. We're at the end of March now. Yes. And it's all rainbows and sunshine and showers. So enjoy the spring and the summer to come. And I look forward to keeping in touch with you virtually on our social media platform. So thank you once again, Kathy.
Oh, well, thank you for having me, Sally.
It's been brilliant. Thank you. Bye-bye, Kathy.
Bye.
Thank you very much for listening to the Neurodivergence and Mental Health podcast. Links and resources will be at the end in the show notes. I very much look forward to meeting you again. Thanks for listening. Bye.